Okay.
Hello, everyone. So, since this is a very big topic, I've basically had to condense myself down to a couple of things I can talk in. So I hope I caught the right things to talk about. But yeah, basically what I ended up going over a little bit is the myths, the money, and where we have a little bit of the big priesthood kind of a theme going on, because that's like, if you talk about AI, you have basically two conversations. The on-the-street conversation is like, oh yeah, this is useful, this is cool, you can do this and kind of that, and you have a little bit of fun, and you have a little bit of devices that can do stuff, you try stuff out. And then you have the social media, which is like, we are all gonna die. I figured we need to address a couple of those myths, because some of the things are not really as dark as they seem on the first look. And we can see how a couple of those are really solvable or not a problem outside of the US. So the point of this talk is to be kind of a little bit of a positive outlook on the whole situation, take care of like what really is the main negative points, and show you, hey, there's things that can be done about this. Maybe not in your local area, but they can do something. So let's look at the big four doom scenarios that have been touted about. I think everybody knows them already, but it's good to have them iterated. We kind of remember the whole XC kind of deal, where one maintainer retained too much things. I think here in this scenario, it's very common to know. Unpaid volunteers don't really have time to do things. And those who get money out of the open source work we do, the revenue went down quite a lot. So Tailwind is most commonly used in this scenario because they really have the numbers. And they had an 80% drop. Kind of related on how the AI uses versus how the AI uses their code versus how they made money. And certain profiles now change and things like that is going on. So this is actually a kind of a bit of a problem because we can't rely on this kind of model. On the other side, some other companies that had different models went like, hey, we now get so many security liabilities through this because the AI can just read our code. We can't react that fast. We have a problem. We have just a couple of people and we need to react to 10,000 people running 10 AI bots each. That's kind of a scaling issue if it comes to something really popular. So some, like Cal.com, went closed source and say like, okay, we can't take the risk. Otherwise, we have a problem. And some burned out, some walked. That's kind of like the big one, number one. That's like, hey, there is something going on with our model, how we make software right now. We need to think about it. And the next kind of the big thing is coming in. It's like the money, the whole AI bubble. Everybody knows, oh, it's the big three. It's three big companies where each of them kind of has a little bit of a different story why they do what they do. And I'm going to talk what they're actually doing later in the talk. But when you look at it, you have Anthropic, which is kind of like a fork of OpenAI, and says like, oh, everybody's going to doom and we're going to do. They said we need to be scary about this. They're just addressing a market OpenAI never could, and they're basically being fear porn. You have OpenAI, which is Sam Altman running away from his bankruptcy towards a new bankruptcy, which is going to be even worse. And you've got Elon Musk, which is doing the same thing because he kind of bought Twitter at some point. He made it X and, well, crashed it. So now we have kind of like three people running into an IPO, kind of like we need to run at a pot of money that we can pay our investors out so they don't hurt us or sue us or whatever the Americans end up doing in the end of the state, whatever they're going to have, whoever rules that state, I don't know. But it's very clearly this is not a traditional IPO. This is really much three companies running away from the mess they're in before these three companies were founded. And three of them found AI to do it, kind of a thing. This looks very much like, too big to fail, using it as we're too big to fail, we can't, you have to buy us out, kind of like as a backstop kind of deal. And the last one, which kind of not as important here in Europe, but more in the US, the data centers started drinking the river. There started being river levels reported below what they should be and everything. And also here again, you look at what it is, and I'm going to have like a detailed tech talk why it's that stupid, as it's stupid. But these data centers are being built for AI. Allegedly. I'm going to say allegedly because I don't know they are. If you look at the data centers they build, they're kind of stupid what they build. Let's take it. So when we look at that, if you see all the headlines and go like, the data centers are ringing the river and this is because of AI, you could say, okay, yeah, AI has a problem. But it's not the problem. As I've hinted before, there is more to each story. So let's take a little bit of a detour and go like, okay, so if there is details to each story, but why do the AI people even go this way? Why is this happening around? There's details around. What's the core? Well, let's follow the tracks a little bit down. We have a couple tells, and you may have noticed, people are pausing signups. So we have a big coming in myth that says, hey, we can't even calculate those AIs. They're inefficient. They will never be efficient. Well, yeah, we are running out of capacity. But we're not running out of capacity because we can't calculate them. We're running out of capacity for a very different reason. And everybody has to buy capacity from each other. SpaceX had some capacity left over because they were only using 15%. And Anthropic was like, hey, I'm buying 1.25 billion per month. You can buy 1.25 billion one time and say, okay, we buy capacity, and then make the loss on it. If you buy 1.25 billion per month, somehow you have to get that money in. Otherwise, even the simplest Excel sheet is going to tell you you're going to be dead in 2 months. And yes, they're making that money with the token prices. It very much looks like the token prices are positive once they calculate in the things a lot. And of course, in a balance sheet, you can hide all your revenue if you want to, because SpaceX has a satellite company, has an AI company, has Tesla built into the same holding. So you're not going to see the earnings on SpaceX's balance sheet. You're going to see a loss from Starlink because they buy all the space around space. I mean, that's expensive, one-time expenditure. So you're not going to see it in the AI bill for a while, so you have to break it down. But when you break it down, they start to become positive. They start to making money off it because they can simply grab the money from the enterprise users. Companies like Uber, like every company that you work for, every team subscription that is not personal pays the API rates right now. And all of the free companies are, at least Anthropic is already scheduled to become positive within like next 1 or 2 months. We'll see how the reports go. They haven't come in yet. The other two are there as well. And SpaceX is basically saying, oh, we have compute. We just sell it to Anthropic. And if Anthropic becomes positive, they spend 1.2 million billion to SpaceX a month. It's not going to take long until SpaceX has the capital incentives gotten back. So this is the thing one. And another thing that we can look at is the intelligence per dollar that you spend. And you get a lot all of a sudden per dollar. So it's not like we could just get more models, we just throw on more compute, we just let more things calculate. But they're also getting more efficient in the background. Like you can see it in the statistics. So what is it that everybody wants? Well, here's the little thing. Yeah, we come to questions. And here's the little thing. The very specific chip that can calculate the AI. That's hard to make, and we don't have them. We have a little problem. You see this little line here going from all the big memory you all need? You need like a terabyte of memory, and you need it in the graphics card. There is no graphics card that has that much memory. And you need it on every graphics card you have. We can't produce that at the moment. That's where all the thing is happening at the moment with the RAM price and everything. Because everybody's running to produce this. You have the Mac Minis with the Interlinks. You have the graphics cards from NVIDIA with their ginormous memory capacities that they can shuttle around between the graphics cards. All of them is to feed these little tensor here so they can calculate what we need and not idle around. And that's the issue. So, what do we have here? We have something scarce. What happens if every cloud company finds something new scarce they can put into their data center? Remember, the cloud is just another person's computer. Of course, they're going to go for the business model where the AI is just somebody else's graphics card. Silicon Valley 101. So they want to own it. Business model, Silicon Valley. So, what do we have as a problem? It's governance. How do we own what is there and how do we structure it so we don't run into the problems that we're running right now? Getting a good organization for each part. And here, let's look at the little things, what is going wrong at the MIFS, because additionally to just the scarcity of the computer, there is more going wrong. The AI data centers, for one, have an evaporation cooling. That means that's not a closed-loop water cooling. They simply drain the river, cool once, and then evaporate it into the air. And they do that in the desert. Why do they do that in the desert? Somebody gave them a tax break. Quite a substantial one, actually. In German, it's called Mehrwertsteuer or value-added tax. So basically, every equipment you buy the value-added tax so that the state owns something, and that's sometimes between 30 to 40%, depending on where you are in the world. And they just waived it. There's apparently a way that states can waive that in the US without having to coordinate between each other. And they've used it before. Turns out, if you have a $1 billion investment, not having to spend $500 million on taxes is kind of important. And every state in the desert was so anxious to get workplaces that they gave those tax breaks without thinking too much. So you have data centers that evaporate water, are located in the desert, and are giant. Big enough to have the usage of a bigger town, which somewhere in the north, say Canada, Northern US, not really a problem. In the desert, it's kind of a problem. you could even do a better cooling. We have such systems here in the Switzerland. In the valley where I live in Zurich, we have ambient air cooling with heat reusage. So the heat of the data center is put into a heat network and roughly serves around 11,000 households, give or take. If you can, of course, the US company is going to come to Switzerland. It's going to say, oh, we build a US data center here somewhere in an enclave, Beringen, in Schaffhausen, not reuse the heat and have an evaporation cooling for the Rhine. Of course, the water numbers all of a sudden look insane. They go like, oh, we need 55,000 gallons a year of Rhine water just to cool our data center in a small town in Beringen. Yeah, not really good. So the point here, we can get good data centers, but the data center organization that makes it needs to be willing to make it, and the state that allows it needs to tell that organization, hey, you need to at least integrate with where you're around. You need to put something like a business park inside of it. Big office buildings, 10,000 jobs. Well, that's insane, but a couple of thousand people that could work, a couple hundred people, a couple smaller companies. So it's not just a big company having that office. They just rent office space because they have it. And that really increases the tax of a location because now there are companies able to work there. There's workshops being able to build there because one guy made a big investment with his big data center and the other companies just have to rent it or buy the shops or whatever model you want. But you have to plan this in. This is organizational on a state and also on the organizational level, because in my valley where we have this like nice data center here, you have two companies that work together, and these two companies got formed because the people there wanted to form them. And that is important. It's the people on the ground that really say, hey, we could use that power. Let's make something with it. Let's learn about the technology that we have. Let's make something fun with it. And the bubble is a governance failure too. Kind of a little bit of a bigger one on Wall Street. The Nasdaq has fast-tracked Elon's IPO, and that's a rule they wrote because of Elon Musk. That rule didn't exist before his IPO, and it's very specifically allows him to go in, and even if he has 85% of the vote, he's allowed to go in. That was a rule that existed before. You have to give up a certain amount of vote for the public market, so you can't just pull a bad decision. There's a certain rule that was before that, and they changed it. That's not good if you change social contracts, especially when it comes to money. And everybody has to buy it. So something in the finance world that exists is an index fund, and they have, by law, to follow that index. So if the index all of a sudden changes that rules, and the index fund still has to buy the shares, as long as everything goes good, nobody's going to complain until the rule is really exploited. And there is the governance there to say, like, hey, we can't just change the rules. We have a social contract here. We need to know what we are doing. And what I showed you is there. The other thing is cornering a scarce resource. Water is a scarce resource. Several other things are scarce resources, electricity. If you have to produce it, there is usually a regulation that you can't just buy up 40% of the market, non-binding, and break it and then make another non-binding agreement with the same company for the same thing. Usually at some point, the regulator is going to come in and is like, the other guys just sued you because you bought every piece of RAM and didn't pay. What the hell are you doing? Of course, the problem is internationally, there's not really a governance organization for this. World Trade Organization technically exists, but they do other things. They do between governments. Now we have private organizations that are as big as governments. They act on the same level, and they're not regulated at all. It's the Wild West. So, one buyer, if he's famous enough, doesn't have to prove anything, can go to the big CEO and say, like, I'm buying everything you have. Is he going to use it? Nobody knows. But, hey, he said he's going to buy everything he has. He's famous. Must be good. Right? Well, should be regulated. And the last thing that's a little bit dear to myself as a maintainer, and I think hopefully a little bit in here, is we at some point in the FOSS space need to be aware that we also will need some regulation for our own protection. Everybody that comes in, and I've seen this pattern over the last couple of years, funds the audience of the code you're writing, not the writers of the code. In that situation, you are guaranteed burnout because the guy you actually need to support doesn't get the support, and the guys that demand things of him get support. That doesn't help. So I don't know how to solve that one or how to make it a bureaucratic nightmare. Maybe a hosting agreement or something. Like GitHub could jump in, but GitHub is failing its own features, so. Still working? Okay. So everybody has a little bit of a story about that. Yeah. When we think of AI, we can think of a couple things focused on AI that we can use to actually make AI use a little bit more ethical, quote unquote, or more like useful for us as people, as users. And I've figured out a couple of things that we can do that. So I figured I'll present those. And you see me use a MacBook, and everybody else out there probably uses Linux or their own operating system or things on their own desk. Because when you use a MacBook, you need to trust Apple that they don't screw you over. Virtual integration requires trust. So a lot of people use Linux. That's not vertically integrated. You can grab almost any hardware from anywhere. You can put the kernel on. You can put your own desktop environment on. You can tinker with your desktop environment as your hobby and lose yourself in it. But that little structure, you can replicate too with AI, where you have this, let's take Claude Code, Claude, Anthropic. You can get the models right now until the US is restricting it, which apparently they do so, from this morning. You can get the models in other hosters, but you have to get it to combine to really get the experience. The point is, that's not necessarily true. You can split it up into multiple layers. You can split it, and these are the three layers I see that we can do. We have tool, which is what you use on your computer. That's the software. You have the model that somebody creates for a purpose, or that has certain features, and that has certain capabilities. And you have the compute. That's, at the moment, the guy that owns the graphics cards. Could be your own computer soon, once the NPUs and neuromorphic chips are ready. But compute is a little bit of one that we can get in, but we can each of them make own small little organizations that can work in the bigger ecosystem. You can make a cooperative for compute that owns the graphics cards. Okay, it's off the shelf, it's black market, it's whatever you can get your hands on for cheap, but you can share it between each other. You can make better sharing agreements. You can make your own sharing things. You are not reliant on everybody else. Of course, yes. Electricity, hosting, somebody has to fix it. We know the problems. But it's a possibility now when you have the separation. The model is even more important because here's where all the innovation comes in at the moment. We have a limitation, that is the compute and the memory, and limitation brings creativity. Same way with game development. Remember the old DOS days when you had 640 kilobytes of memory and nobody's going to ever need anything more, according to Bill Gates? Well, he did inspire a certain creativity on how to use lower memory and high memory and switch it around and all of that. And all of the model innovation is coming there. Mixture of experts, which is like how many weights are active at the same time, how are weights driven, how are architectures driven that we can get into them, how much of knowledge do we need in a model and how much data do we need in a model versus how much behavior do we need in a model. How much does it need to behave well and read everything it gets? And what does it read? Does it read the full file every time? Or does it just read a list of classes? Like you have this little output where you have, when you have your .NET DLLs, you get your list of classes where you can say, oh, this is this, and this is this method, this is this signature, and you have this structured information. Is it just reading that, which is a couple tokens, or the whole file, which can be a couple thousand tokens? And when does it read what? And then you have the tool which needs to facilitate all of that, or different workflows. And there you can, with the newest models like Gamma 4, you have literally tokens where you specify which message is thinking, which message is a user message, which message was back from the model, and then you switch it around in the cache and the context. So you have the binary and the text representation of both, you have to calculate back and forth, and you have to really optimize what that model sees because it only has a, it has a decent context. But when it sees the right thing and it knows how to do the right thing, it doesn't have to assume. All of a sudden, the hallucinations go away. Of course, a model will assume and hallucinate once it is got like, I just don't know how it thinks. I think it should be this. I hope it is. And it may fail on. But this is where you can get the innovation all around. And this three things back here, there is a very good thing here. Because all of a sudden, your personal data only becomes important for the tool. You don't want personal data in the model weights because you don't have the RAM to run them. You have a constraint. You want as little personal data in the model as possible. More behavior, more patterns, more, and those need to be anonymized because if you assume some roles, all of a sudden you change the flexibility of the model. But the tool really has personal data that the final output is helpful for. Like, oh, I want to send my mother something. You write, I want to write my mother an email. And the model goes, who's your mother? If the tool knows who your mother is, the model will only need to know at the calculation time, and that is stateless. Of course, the compute guy could grab off your stream, little Wireshark possible, but there is a little, that's one trust relationship you have to certain people. It's not you need to trust everything. So that's a certain improvement we can make, and that we can make today. We have Ollama.com, that's only a compute provider. We have the open weight models, which are only a model provider. And we have tools that are only on the tool layer and no other layer. Like OpenCode. You stitch those three together, you get a subscription where you can run pretty good models like DeepSeek. Okay, I had to put a little bit of a machine, our famous priesthood of the machine from sci-fi. Everybody knows who that is. If not, well, tough luck. The labs guard their weights very heavily. They want an API to them. They want to own it. They want to meter it because that's how they make money. So again, we see they make money with it, but in the same time, they close the Bible. They retreat. It's like the old priesthoods where you got into front of somebody. Somebody had a book up in front of them and they were talking to you. You didn't know if they were actually reading from the book. You didn't know what comes back. Is the tool call now optimized? How much compute are they using? Are they optimizing it? Well, probably. But are they actually selling you what you pay for? You pay for 10,000 tokens, but the intelligence goes down with the price, so the model could make more. Now they have an incentive to transparently increase the prices you pay, because now you're on the meter. So very flaky relationship if you have all in one. Of course, with the compute, when you run it, you can sell the idle. If you have a good enough memory pool to have to run the model there, you get a couple of requests in, they're stateless, you run them, you sell the idle, you get a couple token prices. If you can do that as cooperative, maybe a good model, maybe not. It's an experiment to do. And the designer labels that. We've had commons a long time, so we will come up with a model and examples on how rules, which 8 rules are important. The Almend is quite a thing. There is other researchers mentioning Ostrom, who has researched all of that. Interesting for those who really want to go like, oh, please set up something for ourselves. And it's not magic. It's known things how what we need to do. You get a little bit of a rate there, and that is Claude Code has a little bit of optimizations right now. It can run longer. It has the best metrics. You're a little bit behind, but not much. I can run DeepSeek to code equally as well. And I have this open stack, and it works well. You have to little know how the model works. You have to steer it a little bit. You have to do a little bit of a process like spec-driven design, like running your own little company just for yourself with AI employees, a little bit of a fake it around. Then it works well. And then you can figure out which review tactic is the right one. Do you review the code? Do you just not review the code? Do you let the AI test it? How do you review the transcripts and see what it did so you can be certain it was a good thing? But if you do that, you can get really, really productive results. Same as with Claude Code. So, and here's a couple more things. The small reasoning that we are getting around, I've tested Chema 4 12 billion. Where you can directly speak into the model. You don't need a transformer or anything that moves around above. It takes the audio and maps it to its internal memory or internal state and moves around. And there is also the optimization for training versus actually serving the requests, where you can get down to watts of usage, not gigawatts of usage, not graphics cards in your computer watts of usage to like 5 watts for the same result. So how small can you make a model for actually getting reasoning going? Microsoft claims you can make it with 300 million parameters. Somebody has to prove that. You can do that on a graphics card. That's trainable on a graphics card. So, Apple. Experiments to do. Own the silicon, get yourself a good Apple with or something that has unified memory, because you're not using the graphics card memory. You can use your system memory as the memory to calculate the model and do everything on itself. There's a lot of computers coming out with NPUs that have these capabilities, the AMD AI chips, and those are consumer grade. You can just buy them for $500. So, how much usage can we get out of these parts? How much usefulness can we get out of the little compute chip in our thing that we just go, we're not just ignoring it, we're going to hack around it and we're going to... There is also a neuromorphic AI accelerator, which is the memory on top of the silicon transistor. On top of the transistor, it's close to the calculation. those you can get for like $150 as a like empty car into your PC. Fun to experiment. And definitely a hacker level thing to do. And of course, on the tool, everybody can run a VM and run OpenCoded in server mode. And then you can access it whenever you need. You need something that runs your compilers off your laptop or behind the scenes or at running times. Everybody of us has some way to get a server. You can use OpenCode there. The data lives there. If you want to make a tool that does your personal organization with AI, you don't need the model to be your private thing to have the same protection. You can use Ollama Cloud. As long as the tool lives on your own machine, you're good. Because the model is stateless. It doesn't save your personal information. Okay, you need to trust Ollama not to cheat on you and not to hack you and not to wiretrack you. But you get my point. Keep the free apart. We can do a lot to really get good AI services how we would like to have them. With data protection, with open source, with little things that we can do locally. And it's not limited to agent, just this vision thing. It's the whole chain, reasoning, coding, all the things. So yeah, we're not going to be ruled by a set of cabal. We are independent. We can do our own things. We can hack around. We can find some graphics cards on the black market. We're going to be fine. Thank you. Spaß am Gerät. Important. Anybody, any questions? Any topic I haven't covered? Yes. Do we have a microphone?
We have a microphone there. If you want to stand, or we can give one out.
Please use the microphone. Yeah, please stand on the microphone. Thank you.
On the slide with the intelligence per dollar.
Mm-hmm.
What was the unit of the y-axis there? It just had some numbers, but I don't know what they mean.
Got mangled. But it's basically where you have the dollar value versus the index of the benchmarks.
Thanks.
Of course, benchmarks are fudgeable, they are being exchanged, it's a live index, yada, yada, yada. Please do not follow my screen of the model. Go to the benchmark screen and go to the price per dollar screen. Then it's up to date. Yes, please use the microphone.
I think on the slide before chapter 4, there was something about funding the maintainers, not the audience. Yep. What do you mean by funding the audience?
Remember these little startups that showed up that are like, hey, we can do a cryptocurrency to pay contributors? Contributors are an audience. They produce code, yes. They help out, yes, with a direct suggestion. But it's not in the code automatically or maintained by just the contribution. Somebody has to press yes if you hit the button. But the role of the contributor is still in the role. It's not in the maintainer role. And it cannot be because he has no agency. Does that help? Good. Okay. I think that's it. Thank you very much.